Hello, I'm John Waters, and I'm supposed to announce there is no smoking in this theater, which I think is one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard of in my life. How can anyone sit through a length of a film, and especially a European film, and not have a cigarette? But don't you wish you had one right now? And I'm telling you, smoke anyway. It gives ushers jobs. And if people didn't smoke, there would be no employment for the youth of today. So once again, no smoking in this theater.
Yeah,
there's like two of them. Well, there's like one of them, and we covered it. It's the one that we covered.
It's mostly just Conan.
Yeah. That was the one good.
Was that the last episode you were actually on? Was Conan the Barbarian? Because you weren't on Samurai Reincarnation, or were you with Blake?
No, he missed that one.
No, yeah. I wasn't. Oh my god, well, I missed
dude.
Three in a
dude,
row.
You've missed like a bunch. All right, that's all we have to say.
Look, here's what I was doing: traveling. You know, I don't. What's the issue here? I don't see what the. Also,
where were you
traveling? Samurai.
Well, you have to dribble the ball, otherwise it's a call violation.
Oh God!
What's up, Cody? I'm doing Cody's part today.
Oh, I was in Minnesota.
Basketball 101. Congrats!
That's right, baby.
You were doing Shakespeare.
Minnesota for one, Columbia for two. Yes, you know what? I think that's fair. I'm not going to lie, folks. I think that I am unimpeachable here.
I was in the same state as these people I make this podcast with, and I didn't talk to them at all.
All you have to do is simply travel to Columbia with your wife, and then you're fine.
Look,
you get out of the podcast.
I'm not. You can skip as many episodes as you want, dude. God knows I'm all for it. But what I was saying is that this motherfucker, I was bitching in the group chat today because we do this at 10 a.m. now because for some reason it's really important to these guys that they have their 2 p.m. on a Sunday free, you
it's
know,
all,
that time
the
where
morning
nobody
is all
that,
getting ready.
You know,
the
you know that one
all,
part
right.
of
Jason
the weekend where nobody is doing
page.
Anything interesting? You know, like what if we like planned our entire weekend
Sunday,
about that?
Sunday could be a big day for interesting stuff.
Okay,
Sunday,
sure.
Brunch,
an all-time
shut the
lunch.
Fuck up. Anyway, and so Aaron's just like, oh, it's not that bad. Just watch the movie during the week. It's like, motherfucker. Again, if I had shown up for one out of every six podcasts, it would be super easy for me to make all of these movies. I would have all the time in the world to make all these movies because I wouldn't have to worry about it. So
look,
anyway,
when Legend or the Beastmaster comes up at the very end of the year podcast, when we're talking about it as one of the 10 best films of the
year, film of the year,
I'll make
Legend.
Sure to have watched it. Okay.
Sure.
I'll catch up.
There's
you
a
know,
first time for everything.
Anything else I can do? I do my up. Homework. Okay.
Oh yeah.
Maybe there will not be 10 better films than Legend.
Jason, going forward, you may as well just start recording as soon as we hop into the room.
Yeah,
hearing rough drafts of all of these bits is
that's
it's
fair.
Giving
yeah,
me gray hairs.
Do we want to talk about the Malbogio boss fight in Kingdom Hearts some more?
I was gonna say that was as interesting as the Bald Mountain scene in Kingdom Hearts.
I'd love to talk about that some more.
What are we talking about, though?
We're talking about movies we saw or people we met. Actually, neither of those things. At or through the Trilon Cinema, which this one wasn't at, here on Trilove, the literal roundtable podcast. Aaron's back.
Thank you.
And you can find us on Twitter at Trilove Podcast. You can find the Trilon at Trilon Cinema and at Trilon.org. Get tickets and merch and other cool ways to support the Trilon there. My name is Jason Dapness. I use sex like some people use a fly swatter. That's right. I fuck the flies. You can find me on Twitter at Nintendoofus.
God, this movie embodies my greatest nightmare, which is being mistaken for a much shorter man. I'm Cody Caplet Narveson, and you can find me on Blue Sky at Cody Narveson.
In the world of podcasting, there's no such thing as a lie. There's only expedient exaggeration. I'm Harry Mackin, and you can find me on Twitter at Punishtake.
My name is Aaron, and I'm not going to share my socials, and I don't have a quote. Instead, I'm going to use this platform to simply say 2024, 2025, we are bringing back butt chins. They have been gone for too long. They have been gone from society. I can't even name a current actor as a butt chin. Not a single one. Cannot name.
Does Glenn
one.
Powell have a butt chin?
Well, wait a minute. What about the
Glenn Powell might.
The guy who played Harvey Dent? Aaron
Eckhart.
He's got a huge butt chin.
He's got a butt
chin.
Glenn Powell does not have a butt chin.
I don't
but
think
he
even has a chin.
Symbolically,
does
have
he?
A butt chin. Glenn Powell
I think
has the
his face is just teeth on the bottom.
Yeah, I'm going to counter this. The year of no chins. Robert Mitchum Hive, rise up.
That's
baby.
Right. Well, what did they call him? Old Twinkle Eyes? Old Gumpy Eyes? What was it? He had a really good name, a nickname. It was like old Butthole Eyes
old
or something.
Wet eyes, something like that.
Yeah.
Actors with butt chins.
All you need to see is this old drawing
Cary
Grant that
oh
I found
God.
On the internet. It's
that's
by,
incredible.
It's
by
perfect, because it
Al
really
Hirschfeld.
Truly embodies how every single Cary Grant movie is like, hey, what if the most attractive man to women who ever lived, like reality bendingly attractive man, to the point where like 26 year olds are throwing themselves at like this 50 year old guy, was also just the gayest, bitchiest queen who ever walked the face of the planet. And like, what if both of those things were true? You
know? That scene where he crawls over to the other woman's hospital room and she's like, stop. And he's like,
stop.
And the scene ends. That was going to be one of my drunk thoughts, but it's too appropriate here. It's fantastic. Thank you very much for listening. I should say before Aaron's summary that this movie played as part of Hitchcock 125. It actually played at the Heights, I believe. It was the next edition of the annual Hitchcock series that plays here in the Twin Cities. Maybe you can catch it next time it comes around next year. But that series is now over, so you can check that out at the link in the show notes. However long those pages stay up on the Trilon's website, you might be able to poke around and see exactly when this played or whatever. It was DCP. Anyway, I'm going to let Aaron take it away.
Arguably not a Trilon movie at all, but also like, you know, Fantasia was put on by the Cult Film Collective, and maybe I'm, you know, shout outs to the Cult Film Collective. Love them very much. Fantasia may be the furthest thing from a cult film that there is.
There, you know.
Didn't we make this joke last year with the Wild Bunch, maybe?
I think so, but like somehow less a cult film than the Wild Bunch is Fantasia.
You misread. It's not cult film. It's a cult film, which is where the Night of the Ball Martin. Yeah. That's where that fits in.
Movies that led to cults being formed.
Yes.
One of which being The Wild Bunch. Check all of that out at Trilon.org, including stuff about the Cult Film Collective, tightly woven groups there. But before you do any of that stuff, sit down, put your podcast player at 1.25 speed or 1.5. There's only one wrong way to go, and it's listening at natural speed. And listen to Aaron give his patented Aaron Grossman summary of today's movie, which he always starts with a quick...
Yes, indeed, folks.
Thanks, Jason. This is actually going to be a very quick one because I am assuming that everyone knows about this movie. We're talking about North by Northwest, 1959 film directed by Alfred Hitchcock. The film follows the misadventures, I guess you could say, of advertising executive Roger Thornhill after he mistakenly gets confused for a man named George Kaplan. Kaplan, a fictitious Cold War secret agent for the United States, is being searched for by anti-U.S. spies, and Thornhill gets ever increasingly dragged into the world of espionage as he tries and fails to prove his identity and innocence. Along the way, Thornhill meets and falls in love with actual secret agent Eve Kendall, and the two work together to try and stop the spies from leaving the United States with valuable government secrets. Cary Grant as Roger Thornhill and Eva Marie Saint as Eve Kendall. Side note, still alive at the age of 99.
Wow. The goat. Oh, man, she's so great.
Yes, which is probably still a knockout early too. On. This is one of those ones where you're like, everyone in this movie is very clearly dead. But no, she's still kicking it. Nice job. Not really too much of a point in going over the film's various nice accolades. It is North by Northwest.
It is indeed North by Northwest. Relevant to our audience, if you've ever seen that meme of Peter Griffin running toward the camera and it says, don't type blank in the GIF search bar or whatever, worst mistake of my fucking life. That's where that comes from.
The true cultural
legacy. Fuck off, Jason.
That's the piece you need to know.
Jesus, you Gen X piece of shit. It's like, oh, wow, North by Northwest got that from Family Guy. Fucking internet asshole.
There was a YouTube video that was like a Family Guy North by Northwest parody scene comparison, and it's, you know, North by Northwest scene on the bottom and it's Family Guy scene on top, and it's there's no gag there. It's literally just the scene that they recreate in Family Guy. It's like, okay, Family Guy.
I mean, most of Family Guy is for people who want to point at their screens and clap like seals, right? That's kind of the main demographic of that show, so it makes sense.
Perfect show. Aaron, you started out by saying that it is like, maybe everybody knows about it. I found myself stuck a little bit because I was watching the latter half of it this morning. I watched half of it last night. I still thought we were doing Fantasia. That's why we were talking about Fantasia. And I watched the second half of it this morning before Sky was up. She joined like in one of the final scenes where he's peering over the ledge to listen to Van Damme's conversation with Martin Landau. I forget his character's name.
She was like, wow, this is the longest set piece of all time. And also, how are there that many ledges on the Rushmore?
Maybe this, you know, cinema sin I'll bring up is like, she definitely heard that gunshot, right? There's no possible way she didn't hear the gunshot. And if she heard the gunshot and then she saw her guy alive, maybe she knew that she was a blank and that they had found her out. And then she later expressed a surprise about being found out. Whatever. But I was more like, actually, I was, maybe I am just like guy pointing at screen and clapping like Seal, but I was finding it very hard to explain in the moment because she had caught the first part of this where he's like misidentified. He's the wrong man kind of thing. And he's hot on the trail. He's trying all the guy's clothes at the hotel room, everything. And then trying to explain where all these characters are at the end and sort of like the triple plot threads and stuff. I mean, I know that this movie has great provenance. There's a great deal. This is my first time seeing it all the way through. A great deal that I did not know that it like tries to weave together. And I think it's really interesting to consider it in like as late stage Alfred Hitchcock and like his particularly his career. There was a quote from the screenplay writer that made me think a lot differently about this movie that I checked out after watching it. So anyway, that's just my thought is like there are for as well known as it is and for as like as maybe pigeonholable as you can make it, it's there's actually still a lot here to unpack, especially as like if I'd watched it in one sitting, it probably would have made it a little better. If I had like was able to discuss it with somebody next to me who had seen the whole thing, it would have been like, ooh, everybody's like pointing at the screen and having a good time. It's just got that natural classic like Hitchcock, oh, the reveals and the cinematography and everything. But also there's this edge I was hoping to bring about at some point here, edge about like, you know, later on in Hitchcock career, considering elements of his own filmmaking style and his own provenance, and like he's like seeing himself on screen in a less literal way than he usually is, I guess. Just a really fun time at the movies. Anybody else want to talk about fun times at the movies?
Sure, I'll kind of piggyback on that and hopefully pass off to Harry here. I think that that kind of the main thing for me watching this, and I think like watching, I watched Rear Window not that long ago, and I think there's something about Hitchcock's best films that kind of show that I think Hitchcock is maybe better than probably any other like single filmmaker that I can think of at making films that are like extremely well-rounded and nuanced in like multiple different areas. Right. I think that like
even genres,
I think it is impossible to like pin down just like one interesting thing to analyze when viewing this film, because there are so many different aspects of it that are, feel weirdly nuanced and ahead of their time, right? I think that you could explore this film as like a, you know, an exploration of kind of masculinity in the 20th century, right? You could view this as an exploration of like advertising and marketing as an industry and how that kind of, you know, relates to 20th century American politics. You could talk about Cold War politics. You could talk about how this film almost feels like an ahistorical commentary on like spy films and like, you know, big action.
Yeah, it's like a parody of James Bond that came before James Bond. It's crazy. Yes.
It's wild, right? And I think that like that is the thing that like Hitchcock kind of does best. I've said this before about him, but like I don't need like Hitchcock to like provide like the deepest dive ever on the Cold War or whatever, right? But like Hitchcock is so good at like kind of fine tuning every direction that his films tend to go in, and they go in so many different directions at once. Right. And I think that like this is a good example of that, because unlike something like Rear Window, this is a movie that a lot of Hitchcock's movies are kind of centered around one core conceit. Right. And like this is too. And that like, you know, there's this idea of this mistaken identity and like this kind of everyday man getting thrown into this like extreme circumstances just due to fate. But I think that like pushing that aside a bit, this is not a film that is based around like one kind of core mechanic in the same way that something like Rear Window is. And I think like in a way this movie like kind of allows you to see Hitchcock kind of flex his muscles as like this very, very skilled filmmaker, this very skilled writer, this like absolute expert at like creating tension and like setting stuff up and paying it off later. And I think that like this film does that, and I think it can be easy to view that kind of stuff through films like Rear Window because they are a bit more obvious. But I think like this is like an incredible movie. So I don't know, Harry, where do you want to take it from?
First of all, no, that was very well said. Welcome back, legitimately, Return of the Mac, etc. I agree with all of that, and also like I think that like what you covered that I really wanted to say is that this is like a film review of Hitchcock's. It's like he's playing the hits, right? This is like looking back on his career and being like, hey, like this is all the stuff that I do best. I'm going to put it all in one movie and I'm just going to have fun with it. I love so much that this comes hot on the heels of Vertigo. It's like the fundamental symbolic opposite of Vertigo. Vertigo is like the ultimate sort of downer movie. It's like the most self-serious movie ever made in a way that I love very much, right? Like, Vertigo is my favorite Hitchcock by like a really wide margin as a humorless, sentimental scold. Everyone should not be surprised by that, obviously. It feels like after that, like a year later, he was like, let's do a silly one. You know, and he made like what I think is like one of the funniest and self-parodying movies of all time. In addition to everything else Aaron just said, it's like this is a piss take on his entire career, basically, in the most loving way possible. It's like it's a parody of Hitchcock plots. It's a parody of Hitchcock characters. And it like through the lens of being this sort of like self-reflexive review of his film career, it's also this weird, hilarious criticism of the 20th century and like of American politics and the Cold War and McCarthyism, right? It just in the sense that it's like it's about all of these people who are trying to do something and being kind of ridiculous about it, but that ridiculousness somehow still shaping the world in which we live in a way that I found really fascinating. It's like it's Hitchcock's Burn After Reading. Like I could not stop thinking about Burn After Reading while I was watching this movie. And like in the same way in that it's like it's sort of a later career thing. It's somebody who's very assured and it's somebody who is just like almost like seeing what happens when they turn their own tropes inside out and like really like shake them for what they're worth. And so you get this movie that is like it's comprised of like all of these beats that are versions of what Hitchcock is doing in other movies and somehow fit together into this grander story, right? Even though it doesn't really make sense for this movie to be what it is. I guess my big take about this movie is that the beginning of this movie to me is so perfect and so delightful that I was almost disappointed when it becomes a more conventional thriller. I knew it had to, right? But like just the idea that like for a minute there it looks like this movie is going to be about this like it's suspiciously unmarried middle-aged advertising executive who has a very close relationship with his mother trying to like prove an international conspiracy in order to get out of a drunk driving ticket, basically, right? And like it's like this like like farcical mystery like comedy where he's like going into this apartment and his mom doesn't believe him and they have this amazing back and forth where she's like, no, you're just a drunkard, like just pay the fucking fine. And he's like, no, mom, you don't get it, like Russian spies are the reason why I got caught drunk driving. And it's like, we know he's right, but like just like the situation.
I used that same excuse.
Right, exactly. It's so good, right? And like, it's like,
this is spies again.
It's the funniest shit. And like, he does it so well. And the script is so good. And he's leveraging Cary Grant so well, right? Like, this is, what is it like? I think it's like 19 years, maybe not quite, after His Girl Friday. And like, you can totally tell that like, that's just like the quick talking, like crackerjack writing. It's just like, everything's firing on all cylinders, and like it almost like when it has to become a conventional movie, it almost loses a step to me, but only because the first act is so much fun. And then somehow, even though he transitions from this like really a farce into something that is more dramatically conventional with Eva Marie Saint and with Cary Grant sort of embodying this guy, this reluctant hero, It pulls it off anyway, right? Like it really keeps you coming along for the ride. And I think that's what I love so much about this movie is that like without losing anything, it keeps tacking more and more stuff on. And everything that it tacks on continues to be successful.
Yeah, much like us. I think this movie is fun, masterful, and all the other good stuff you said. No, I can confirm that upon rewatch, this movie keeps getting better. I did struggle with this one like early on. I think the first time seeing it was in like for a class in college, and like wanting to sink my teeth into something and having seen from Hitchcock only Rear Window before coming into North by Northwest, and just like being prepared for one, and like Aaron was characterizing this pretty well, but just like it's a different type of like engagement. Like Hitchcock is still engaging with the same sorts of things, but just like the level to which things are in your face That's something that I'm still kind of wrestling with. I've come around to like revisiting this every couple years. I really enjoy watching it. My early sort of characterizations, and I've invoked the idea of a hangover movie on this podcast before. But like weirdly, if you just like look at it very surface level, North by Northwest is kind of like the king of hangover movies in that it's like, it's long.
Harry tested, Harry approved, baby.
Like it's long, but it moves. Like kind of take like the this is a grown up podcast, Jason.
I mean, hey, if Hitchcock can make a movie comprised entirely of double entendre, why can't we do the same with a podcast?
Oh, maybe the best last shot of any movie, for what it's worth. But like it's long and it moves. Insert giggles here. It's relatively quiet. There are like standout loud scenes that you hopefully like you perk up for, the airplane sequence, basically marking the middle of the movie, those sorts of things. There's a lot of plot that you can miss, which is great when you're kind of floating in and out of consciousness on your couch. I mean, all that is to say it is like, getting back to like the well-roundedness of this movie. That is sort of like, and all this sounds kind of backhanded and I don't necessarily mean it that way anymore. Whereas like watching this freshman year, like definitely just like, oh, this movie is boring. I want, yeah, just like dirty explorations of shitty dudes, which like this movie isn't not doing, but like it's a well-rounded, like thoughtful thriller with a lot of different threads that like are there if you choose to engage with them. I think a lot of people do, just based on how many people I see go to bat for this movie as like one of their favorite all-time Hitchcocks. It's not quite like, I'm kind of like Carrie in that like Vertigo is a Vertigo, Rear Window, Dial M for Murder. I'm a big Stage Fright.
Dial M for Murder. Really?
Hey, interesting. Aaron, did you ever find out from Griffin if you watched Stage Fright ever?
I did respond to him.
I saw that like nine hours ago.
Well, yeah, I don't know what it was, but like I for the context here, friend of the pod, Griffin, I was looking through the reviews for North by Northwest and he was like, damn, I should watch more Hitchcock. And then me 4 years ago, probably having just seen Stage Fright, hey, you should watch Stage Fright. He's like, yeah,
guy who's
on
just
it.
Seen Stage
and
Fright
I was like,
voice.
Fuck yeah. It. I'm asking him if he's seen Stage Fright 4 years later. I'm following up on this line of inquiry. I don't think he's seen Stage Fright.
God damn it.
Everybody should see Stage Fright. I did have one more to Harry's point of like maybe a tough entry in Hitchcock's filmography to like lead off with without having more under your belt. At the same time, and this is like a very incomplete kind of mental exercise, maybe it'll start something, maybe it won't, no big deal either way, but like thinking about the comps that you see, like the only one I can really think of is Charade, of like that's the one that's like most often I hear of people being like the number one Hitchcock movie that Hitchcock didn't direct, you know, the most of mm-hmm. that. And it's like I feel like, again, based off very little data, I feel like those comps are like more often than not keying off of this movie more so than something like, unless it's like De Palma's filmography, in which case, it's like Vertigo, Rear Window, like the kind of sleazier stuff.
Yeah.
But like the patient and like very, like cognizant like genre exercises, like a lot of that I feel like can be traced back to something like North by Northwest. So it is in one sense, like I understand showing it to someone as like the way, maybe not like as a way into Hitchcock, but like a way into film in general. Whereas like, if you want to understand Hitchcock's, you know, enigmatic psychotic self a little bit better, maybe like pump this one towards the end because this is aping a lot of his tendencies and sensibilities. But I don't know. Again, that's like a very incomplete thing. I don't know if that's if that goes off of anything you wanted to toss out there, Jace. But that's kind of where I'm at with this movie. Like pretty positive. Not like I'm not over the moon for this movie, but like I very much enjoy coming back to it like on a relatively routine basis.
Yeah, it actually does. I really like comparing. There's so much to uncover when comparing this movie to his other movies, and especially movies that came before. Because it's less like a lens into where he was going to go or what he was going to perfect, and more like, again, like Harry and I were mentioning earlier, like a consideration of what he had done previously. Like this is, I haven't seen all Hitchcock films, but of the Hitchcock films that are best known, especially the ones leading up to this, there's a distinct sense of like, constrained space, like Cody, we're describing a certain like focus. Aaron, you were saying like a real deep dive on like a Rear Window, like a very specific plot thing that just you uncover the varying layers of in this sort of knotted web. This, it blows out to incredible epic proportions. I was saying, that quote from his name was Ernest Lehman, the screenwriter of this movie. He wrote it with Hitchcock. He said that he wanted to write the Hitchcock film to end all Hitchcock films. And his explanation for that quote later on was that something that was witty and entertaining, lots of suspense and all kinds of colorful locales, things like that, everything that I'd enjoyed in Hitchcock pictures from the past. And that's kind of like
sort of a perfect like log line for this movie.
And it seems like table stakes, but then like watching it, I guess with that, the best way I can think of it is like in a normal Hitchcock film, and I'm normal, like the ones that have gotten a lot of talk on this podcast, Stage Fright and Rear Window and Vertigo, maybe not The Pleasure Garden, but like his better known ones that have gotten play on this podcast. There's like he has this constant through the style and through the writing and through the performances that he's directing. There's this constant like mustache twirling, like, you know, there's somebody who knows what's going on that you don't, kind of thing. And in this, it's more like and I felt really, really funny when I said this, so please nobody make me feel bad about this. It's like more like he's seeing a bus stop ad for himself and like drawing a mustache on it. Like he's just having a little bit of fun with himself some years later. And, you know, this was a year after one of his most popular films. And thank you.
I like that a lot, Jason.
A year previous to it. Thank you so much. I really appreciate this. They don't have a side chat going where they're like, what a fucking stupid analogy. But like, in terms of like, quote unquote, late stage Hitchcock, and I only say that because like he directed what, like 30, 40 movies or something crazy like that before this, both talkies and non.
It was like maybe like one of the most visible auteurs of all time by the time this came out, right? Everybody was like, everybody knows what a Hitchcock movie is. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows these tropes. Everybody would have watched this movie knowing what he's doing and what
exactly
he's playing with.
And that is why, like Cody was saying, like, I don't know that I would recommend it as an entry point to Hitchcock, because it will read, I think, more like Harry is saw the last maybe two thirds, half of this movie, as like pretty conventional thriller. And I'm not saying that there's much like deeper there that doesn't go any further. It's just that is the level on which it's working, unless you're like somewhat versed at least in his previous stuff. And again, I'm no expert, but like he had Psycho, The Birds, Marnie, Torn Curtain, Topaz, Frenzy, and then finally Family Plot in 1976, if I remember correctly. So like this was toward the end of his actual film directing career. It was like peak, at least like in retrospect critically for people. But like, while it certainly has all of that Hitchcock stuff in spades, all of the like, you know, sort of knotted twisting, the things you might not know, and, you know, constant suspense thing, it feels almost like he's like I was saying earlier, like lampshading the very fact that it's a Hitchcock film within the movie itself, where like it's very good at being that straight Hitchcock. I think I'm overly pretty positive about this, where there have been some criticism leveled, I definitely recognize, but I think I'm a little more positive than some of the folks on the podcast here. I just feel like it's, for all as tied up in its plot as it is, as you know, a Hitchcock film tends to be, there is like, even the very driving element of Roger Thornhill, like him accidentally / ending up purposely embodying this fake agent, Kaplan, just to get closer to the truth. Like that all feels so incredibly on the nose Hitchcock that it almost feels like you don't make something like this without trying to, like you said, have a little bit of fun with it, a little tweak it a little bit. There's just like in context of the rest of his movies. And like you said, if he was as well known when this movie released as we now know him today, and he was like, if all eyes were on him as like one of the most promising directors, auteurs, then you got to imagine he was considering, oh, I'm going to make this movie. Everybody knows what I'm about. Everybody's seen some of my biggest movies. I'm going to make this a little bit like of a twist on that, and not like in an overt way or a way that distracts from that essential Hitchcockian like element and that like incredibly well-roundedness, but like just with another I don't know if I'm like I'm elucidating this very cleanly, but just like there is, knowing that this came after some other things that I like more and that sort of solidified and cemented some of his tendencies and some of his best known sort of signatures and hallmarks, knowing that it came after those things gives it a lot more fun and like that juicy sort of like, ooh, there's a certain distinct like more than pop appeal here to this, almost like an inside joke in a way.
Yeah, I think something that I always think about when I think about Hitchcock is that incredible, strange promo he did for Psycho, back in the day where, like, he's in the Bates house and he's, like, walking you through the house and sort of, like, explaining. And like, he's so, like, puckish in that and so, like mischievous and funny. And he's constantly making these, like, double entendre jokes and sort of, like, he's like a fucking MC, right? He's like a circus ringleader where he's just like, come along on like Hitchcock's wild ride. And like, I'm going to take you through the fucking amusement park of my films. And it's like, I think that like, that's a really good way to understand his movies and really a great way to understand him as a director. And it's something that is like kind of rare. And I think that I really value, which is that like, I think Hitchcock, like, as much as he is an auteur, he recognizes that he's an entertainer first and foremost. And like, he blends this pop sensibility that you're talking about, Jason, really well with art, because for him, there is no distinction. I don't think, like, I really don't think that Hitchcock thought of himself as an artist as much as he thought of himself as like an entertainer, right? As somebody who is like here to put butts in seats. It's just that that's all the same thing to him. And mm-hmm. you really see this in here, which is why it's so perfect that like, I've always said that like, I think that Hitchcock makes smart, dumb movies, if that makes sense. Where it's like, it's the sort of thing where like, if you explain the plot of any Hitchcock movie to somebody just in the abstract, you'll sound like a fucking insane person.
There's a bunch of birds.
Yeah, or like...
There's a bunch of birds.
Think about Vertigo, right? Like, one of the most beautiful movies ever made, in my opinion. Like, an unbelievable movie, and it's like, well...
There's a bridge and a tree, and she's sad.
This chick thinks that she's possessed by the ghost of an ancestor. This ancestor's gonna kill him. This detective comes out of nowhere. He falls in love with the ghost. It turns out that he was being conned. There is no ghost, so she's in love with him now, and he thinks that like, but he still wants the ghost, so he makes her dress up, and a bunch of other stuff happens. It's like, bro, what are you fucking talking about? Like, this sounds like the dumbest movie ever made. And I think that like, North by Northwest like antes up, right? It's like, I'm gonna make the smartest, dumbest movie of all time, because the plot of this movie is so dumb, it's so over elaborate, it's so it kind of breaks a bunch of screenwriting rules, right? In that, like, it really, like, revolves around a bunch of, like really unlucky happenstances that happen to this dude.
It's things happening.
Or it's, yeah, yes. It's things happening. It's like, oh, yeah, there's a fake Cold War agent that they have, that they want to throw this guy off the scent of their real agent. It turns out they mistake this guy for that guy. And now, like, this is all going on. And, like, it's Cary Grant, so he's, like, 1 foot in the movie, 1 foot out of the movie, being Cary Grant the entire time. It's like, it almost prefigures, like, I hate to like level this, but like the sort of like really annoying meta humor that we've come to expect from like Marvel movies, except it's a way better version of that, where it's like, it's not meta in the sense that it's calling out the tropes. It's just meta in the sense that it's like, oh, of course, like this guy is played by Cary Grant because he's just a Cary Grant character, like so through and through that it's like, and you just love that so much that you just accept it. And it's like, you can see the movie winking at you, being like, yes, hey, exactly. Like, I'm having a lot of fun. Aren't you having a lot of fun right now? Like, we're going to go to the next scene, and it's going to have a plane that tries to kill Cary Grant.
That's like, the exact feeling I had about
right.
so many like, parts of this movie.
It's like a banquet, right? Like, it's like a 10-course dessert, where it's mm-hmm. like every single scene is like, you go from that scene, and then it's like, well, we're going to get like right after, like, we get a scene where Cary Grant and this unbelievably good, charming woman who plays his mom are having this like rat-a-tat rapport with one another. Like, that's your first half hour to establish the stakes and everything. It's so fucking funny. It's so meta. And then it's like, we're going to transition, and we're going to have this unbelievably like sexy, fun, like rat-a-tat train sequence with Ava Marie Sant, where it's like they're doing things that would have been considered, I'm sorry, I got her name wrong probably. I saw Saint, yeah. Not Sant.
Yeah, that's fine.
Cody, I saw the face.
I tried to hold back the grimace, but we're on camera, bud. There's only so much I can do.
All right, thanks. That's fair. And like, he's doing things that are so audacious and so silly, right? Like, almost everything they say to one another is a double entendre, right? Like it's so overly sexed up that like, it feels like we said with, like, I think everybody says that this was a huge influence on James Bond. I wish James Bond, and maybe the early ones did, took more cues from this in that, like, it's like a parody of James Bond before James Bond, right? Where it's like, this is like, it's so funny to have conversations this sexy with another person mm-hmm. that like it doesn't really make sense, especially like these two people who really have like no reason to act this way. It almost made it frustrating to me when it was like, because like I saw the quote unquote twist, obviously, that she was the double agent coming a mile away. I think everybody does. That's not really the point. But this idea that like, I was like, oh, she's taking him for a ride, and that's why she's acting this way. But then, like, when her actual character is revealed, it's like, oh, no, that's just, like, the person she is. she also just, like, acts this way. And that's okay, because, again, this is a Hitchcock movie. And it's just, like, it's one of those things where, like, he has such a good way of getting you to sort of, like, suspend your disbelief in this, like, very specific way because you are having so much fun and you're being so entertained that, like, it makes all this stuff stick so well, even though it's such a like complete all you can eat buffet of a bunch of different flavors all at once.
It's just like suspiciously on with when every right. scene is this much Hitchcock, which when like you have a scene of him like doggedly chasing down somebody that he's looking for, finding that it's Townsend, finding that Townsend isn't who he thinks it is, and then suddenly there's a knife in the guy's back and one like three frame shot of a guy running away.
It's fucking
hilarious.
Because then, like, obviously Cary Grant, like, grabs the knife and he's just holding it. And he's like, wait, I didn't do this. And there's a fucking journalist right there that snaps his picture immediately. And
the funniest, like, quick camera snap. Yeah. It's so good.
And we cut to the newspaper and it's just Cary Grant holding a knife menacingly over a dead body. And it's just like, ah, fuck, they got me. Like, now I'm wanted for murder and drunk driving. You know, it's a movie where this guy is such a practiced drunk driver that they try to kill him with drunk driving, but he's a Cary Grant character, and so he's just pretty good at drunk driving.
He's an ad executive in 1959 it's or like, whatever.
Yeah, he's Don Draper. It's like, this is just Tuesday night for me. Like, fuck you. It's so right? Like,
I like the fact that they drug him not by like putting drugs into his drink, but just actually feeding him a lot of alcohol. Just like, they just like sat there for 20 minutes and they're like, yeah, take another gulp.
Also, it's like, damn, dude, that's like an $80 bit. You could just like shoot him. Like, that bourbon was probably kind of expensive.
Can you also just chop him up in the bathtub and dissolve him? Like, what are you doing like, here? You know what I mean?
But it's perfect, right? That's the perfect Hitchcock thing. It's like, oh no, like, you don't understand. It's like,
he's getting driven over a cliff.
It's a Bond villain. It's like, we're not even going to drive him off the cliff. We're going to make him drink a bunch of bourbon and then put him in a car and like, he'll kill himself. And it's like, oh, what could go wrong? How could he possibly get out of this one? It's like, oh, you mean he drives off the road and then the police pick him up for drunk driving? Like, exactly what happens in this movie. It's like, ah, shit, who could have seen that coming?
Tacking onto the, like, how this movie is structured, where it derives this specific type of entertainment from, like, the capacity that this movie has to, like, it could have spent so much longer cracking out, like, Cary Grant's character. Like, who is this ad executive? Who is Roger Thornhill? But because we have a cachet of, like, Cary Grant tropes, we have a cachet of, like, busy business guy tropes, like, guy talking to a secretary, all we need is 5 minutes of, like, rapid back and forth walk and talk dialogue. And I guess they're driving for a portion of it, but like him and his secretary, we know everything that we need to know about this guy, his life, his persona. It's just like, get all that out of the way first, 3 to 5 minutes, so that the rest of this, you know, like the subsequent 128 minutes or whatever is like, we are nonstop going place to place. And like another sort of like odd sentiment is, I don't know, I'm going to say it out loud and it's not going to sound as like revelatory, but partway through, just like, man, this antagonist, like he spends the whole movie being wrong about like, not just like, you know, views about humanity type of wrong, but Van Damme just like that's the fucking guy. This is the guy I'm looking for. And he spends a whole movie being wrong about that very basic fact. And that, like,
it's some of the funniest scenes, right? Where it's like, it's an incredible parody of spy movies when it's like Cary Grant is giving this like ironclad evidence that he's not this guy. He's like, listen, man, like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, I don't look like the guy. Here's my ID. Like, I can tell you my whereabouts for like the last 20 years. Like, I've got all these people who can vouch for him. And he's like, yeah, well, looks like your cover story's really fucking good then, because it would be, because you're a professional. And it's like, ah, fuck, like, it is that like Chinese finger trap. It's so funny.
Right. And then on the other side, like, for Thornhill, he is obviously, his life comes to be like pretty endangered, but he's, more than anything, he's annoyed, he's inconvenienced, nobody believes him. And that's just like the thread that this movie is now, or like this tightrope that this movie is now kind of rolling along on, where like there are massive stakes if you kind of squint and look at them, but they're also like, this dude is just annoyed. And that is like, yes, what that is. The stake of this movie.
Right. They cast the best guy ever to be exasperated by ridiculous things happening to him, which is like Cary Grant's entire like steez, and he's better at it than anybody ever has been, where it's just like, you just want to watch Cary Grant like mug to wild things happen.
They let him do it to more than just James Mason too. They let him do it to like an entire room full of wasp like antiques bitters.
That's one of my favorite scenes we could get to, but
very good.
Yeah.
All that is to say, like, if this were a different, like, if Hitchcock weren't just like, let's do a silly one now, and he decided to like lean on the I don't know, the heart of Cold War era relativism, where it's like, this thing is clearly wrong, but we're gonna wait, you know, hour 55 minutes, eventually this will become dangerous because it is now the truth. Like, it doesn't matter whether Cary Grant is this guy or not. Now it's like his life is threatened no matter what. And now like the world is, the world is always in danger because, you know, go read a book. But like, that's, again, it's very like easy and thrilling to see this movie between two different eyes kind of simultaneously. And I get more out of the latter, I guess, of that as I revisit this more and more. But the more we talk, the more impressed I get by that, like, again, that tightrope that Hitchcock set up of just like, you know, it's fun, but also like I'm grimacing as if Harry mispronounced a name. I'm like grimacing at how like slippery this could get for Cary Grant if he lets it, but he doesn't. Spoilers.
Does what you're making me, what you're saying about Van Damme, I think it's James Mason is the character's name. I only recognize his face because he was in Cross of Iron, the Sam Peckinpah
Jean-Claude
Nazi movie.
Van Damme is the, that's right, way you pronounce that, right?
Is like, does he ever learn, before the events of the movie come to a close, that he's not actually Kaplan?
I was thinking back, and I don't know, either he doesn't ever, or there comes a point where he does and he's just like, well, fuck it. Like, I'm about to get on the plane.
We're going to kill this guy regardless.
Yeah, like, right. I mean, his final line is like, you know, that's unsportsmanlike, we're using real bullets, which is a fucking, really fucking funny
absolute
line
banger.
In context.
Like,
but like,
it's all, this movie at no point takes itself seriously.
Right. That's what I love so much about it, is like Cody's saying, there's that like constantly suspended tension between like the if Roger had any, like, if he had proven or disproven the myth that was like, that he was fulfilling over the course, he literally like puts on the guy's clothes and answers his phone. And it's like, well, goddamn it. You're staring at a guy in a horror movie and saying, don't make that, no, don't go through that door kind of thing. And you're just waiting for all these pieces to fall into place, every puzzle piece, without like, you know, operation style buzzing at another piece, just constantly threading this needle. And it just feels so incredibly written, but like Harry's saying, very brought to life by Cary Grant, and is very goofy. Like, he's never not Cary Grant in this movie, I would argue, and that works very much in his favor. Again, like, as a movie, it's making me think more about this movie as like, oh, thinking about like a movie made to talk about movies, how movies have been, like how pieces of stories fit together, and how it doesn't really, like I was saying, it was hard to explain like all the different pieces to Skye as she was watching like the latter scenes of this movie after having only seen the setup. But then I realized I can just say, that's the bad guy, that's the girl, and this is the guy who wants to save the girl. And it all, like, it works from there. That's fine. It, you know, it's a lot less interesting and a lot weaker story, but it kind of works from there. I think that
it works from there until you have to write a fucking summary of this. And then you're like, Thornhill, who's Kaplan, but he's not Kaplan. Thornhill's an adjective.
That's what I...
Kaplan is a spy, but he's not actually a spy. He's not real. Okay. And then you just write three sentences.
You are saying exactly what I was trying to explain to this guy. Enough. I was like, so that guy, he's got microfilm in a, and it was just like, well, I've lost the plot on this. Doesn't matter to a person who hasn't seen the remaining setup, but like, able to enjoy
the MacGuffin could not matter less in this movie. Yes, it's like the fucking Night Moves MacGuffin, where it's just
exactly.
Like, wait a minute, they're like,
it's
they're
burn after reading.
Yeah,
you said it.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For the guy who came up with the term MacGuffin, he has a lot of fun just having like the most MacGuffin ass MacGuffin in this movie. I don't know. It's like a, like I said, like there's a sort of not cynical, but just very joyful. Ah, ha ha ha. You know, I'm Alfred Hitchcock, right? I'm going to do this. I'm going to have the guy. And then I'm thinking again of the line or the scene where like just suddenly the real Townsend has a knife in his back. That's the most like wow, Hitchcock's really doing this. He's like seeing how far I will suspend my disbelief to accept this whole goofy thing.
He's got a knife throwing buddy, and then later on in the movie, they reference it.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Tell your knife throwing buddy that he did a really knockout job. It's like, oh yeah, ADR, sure.
It's fantastic. It's just, man, there's just so much fun to this one that like doesn't require all of the background that we're explaining on like Hitchcock or what's better or what's worse in the comparisons. I think it's just like for this podcast, having been a podcast where we've discussed some Hitchcock before, both movies that we've seen and discussed and movies like just reference points, just a fucking really fun time in and out.
I think that even on a thematic level, this is like a really fantastic review of Hitchcock's movies, right? Like, I think you're right. Like, it straddles the cynicism and the bemusement of Hitchcock really, really well, because it's like, it's this like, it's a movie that only somebody who is like really like astute critic and commentator on postmodernism, who is also made wildly successful by postmodernism, could do, right? It's like, it's basically about this moral relativist, like, who says like there's no such thing as truth, like advertising is the only narrative that exists, who is proven like horribly right beyond his expectations, right? Like, he learns, this is a movie about learning that there are no adults in the room. Basically, that like, oh, like, yes, like, even at the highest level, the CIA is playing these ridiculous games. Like, people are just trying to make out like bandits by like stealing state secrets and shipping them back and forth. We didn't learn anything from this. What did we learn? We learned not to do it again, you know, burn after reading shit. And it's just like, it is the perfect sort of like Hitchcockian thing, right? This idea that like Cole Porter's Anything Goes is like his, like, philosophy encapsulated in film, right? Where it's just sort of like, yeah, like what a wild world that we're living in, where like we are in the Cold War, and the Cold War is this absurd farce that everyone from the outside can see is like a dick measuring contest between the worst people in the world, who also happen to be like controlling all of human history and have levels of power heretofore like unimagined by history. And it's about people getting caught in the middle of this and learning that like, hey, what does it mean when the world is this absurd, when sort of like the ideas, and this is the critique of masculinity and the critique of sort of like nations that Aaron was talking about early on, right? It's like, hey, like what does it mean that like everything has become this stupid and this absurd? And like, hey man, like especially in 2024, like that's a really good theme. Right. And like, I think a lot of Hitchcock shit gets there. And I think that this movie gets there more than most, just because it's having so much fun with the building blocks of Hitchcock's career to be like, hey, like what is a world look like? What does a thriller look like? What does a romance look like in this like post-postmodern world where everything we are doing and seeing is being refracted through pop culture and through like nation state politics? And through sort of like this very meta self-reflexive understanding of ourselves that we have. And it's like, what it looks like to Hitchcock is it looks like hilarious movies like this, where Cary Grant has one foot in the movie and he's Cary Grant. And we are supposed to come to this movie understanding that we are looking at Cary Grant, the man, as much as we're looking at this person. And we are watching this movie. Like, I can see Hitchcock behind the camera in every shot of this movie. And that's the point, right? He like wants you to see him. I don't even know. Does he appear in this movie?
Yeah,
he
usually appears in this movie. He's okay, trying to get on a bus.
He's like catching
a bus. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, it's perfect, right? It's like, oh, like never forget that this is a movie that I am doing an exaggeration of reality, that I am sort of like throwing your reality back at you to show you how silly it is, and I'm making a bunch of money off of it. And isn't that wild and weird and funny and kind of scary? And he's right. TBH. And it's like, it's sort of like the perfect logline for like one of the most successful Hollywood directors of all time, who sort of straddled this throughout his career, right? It was like, I'm going to like make some really important art, and I'm going to make some really successful pop art, and I'm going to kind of comment on both of them. And this is what it looks like looking back.
Yeah. Aaron, since you brought that up, the masculinity, the Cold War politicking, the look back sort of thing, I mentioned earlier, Roger's general, like, he's kind of, he has this like dangerous self-serving attachment to like finding the truth and proving his innocence instead of just paying the ticket kind of thing, getting out from under this. Not that it would have been a clean path, but
pay there, the $2 his mom says to him at one point. It would have been so fucking good.
Better position anyway. Is there anything I'm trying to square that impulse, him as you know, agent of sort of Hitchcock's plotting and his maybe, I mean, he did say, I guess in some interviews that he didn't see any themes or politics or whatever underneath of this. Take him with a grain of salt for that one. But is there anything to his character constantly being like obsessively focused on truth and getting to this like essentially whatever beyond like just getting out from under the danger of the thing? He's got this real pull toward fulfilling this sort of prophecy of being Kaplan, just to find, you know, this element of truth amid this whole discussion of the, you know, sort of a toxic version of masculinity and, you know, the threading of, you know, interweaving truths and the Cold War politicking and stuff. Do those ideas clash together at all for you? Just because you brought up the topic in your initial summary of like how well-rounded it can be. Does that plot element, him as a character just being so driven to find that truth and maybe without a point, does that speak at all to that thematic through line that you picked up on?
Maybe. I mean, I don't, maybe I, this is a misread, but I don't really read him as like driven per se. Right. I think that like he's kind of, you know, classic example of a character who's like thrown into, you know, a series of events kind of against his will. And that kind of momentum just kind of propels him. I think until about the, you know, I don't know, the third of the way through the film, the halfway point, when he finally meets Eve, I think that like, mm-hmm. that is kind of the thing that changes his character, right? Is growing attracted to her, you know, falling in love with her. And then I think that kind of carries it through the rest of the film.
Yeah.
But I think that like the film, I don't see him as like relentlessly like pursuing the truth per se. I think that especially at the beginning of the film, you'd probably be fine just like not being kidnapped and kind of, you know, being kind of left alone per se. But sure. I do also think that like another aspect of his character is like, you know, when he is thrown into these circumstances, like, yes, he is, you know, inconvenienced. He does voice that. But he also is, I think, like relatively smooth at like dealing with it. Right. He like never lets down his sense of humor. And, you know, I think the first scene where he's in the, you know, the cab or he's in the car. Right. And the, you know, there's the two henchmen and they have a gun. You know, he's kind of funny, right? He's smooth. He is still, you know, the guy wearing a cool suit and cool sunglasses, and drinking, you know, a martini lunch, right?
I mean, it cannot be overstated to the extent to which he is Cary Grant, right?
Right.
And it's like, that's very important to his character.
Which is why any actual critique of, you know, kind of American masculinity and like, you know, advertising and marketing and whatnot falls flat, because Cary Grant is actually too cool. He is the coolest fucking guy. He's got, as I mentioned, he's got,
like
the chin,
I said,
it, the best suit of all time.
He's so cool that he is apparently the most clearly gay leading man of all time. And people still argue about that, right? It's like he's queening it up in every single role he's ever been in the best way. And people are just like, man, Cary Grant, they don't make men like that anymore. It's like, okay.
Yes, Cary Grant is too cool for this part, unfortunately. But also it's a mathematical equation here. Is the Cary Grant too cool to make these points in this film? Yes. Does the value of having Cary Grant be this character in this movie outweigh all that dumb bullshit? Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Shut up.
Good mental
Cary Grant, cool blue suit, drinking martinis, doing spy shit. That's great.
Well, I mean, it's perfect for, I think, the whole theme too, right? Which is that like there is sort of a latent conservatism to the traditional Hollywood movie that I think Hitchcock has spent his career sort of critiquing. And here it's like more critiqued and more made fun of than ever, right? Because like this is in its own way, like sort of on paper, it's a movie about a cynic who through his experiences, understanding how truly cynical the world is, find something to really believe in and something to love, right? Like you could make the argument that that's that character's arc, but it's not. Like, come on. like, look at him. He's still Cary Grant at the end of this movie. Like, at the end of this movie, they're just really excited to fuck. They're not, like, you know, this chaste, like, lovely couple who, like, finally...
I don't know what you're talking about. I don't think they ever... They are married. And they are traveling via public transit.
But that's the point, right? Like, it's very important that, like, both of those things exist. That this movie is a traditional picture in that way. In that picture, I sound like fucking Martin Scorsese. But,
Excellent picture.
I love it. I love it. Marty can say picture. It's the most charming thing in the world. I can. It's important that this has, like, that sort of walk away from the edge Shakespearean comedy where everybody ends up okay and gets married at the end and learns the right lessons and the world keeps on spinning right and the kids are going to be all right. But it's also important that it's not that. It's also important that he's still Cary Grant at the end and that the world is still what it is and that we still live in this absurd sort of anything goes world where we are both aware of the tropes in which like narratives are playing out and we can recognize how absurd they are. Right. And like even the name, right? Like North by Northwest basically means like a little twisted. Like that's what it meant in Hamlet. Right. He says, I am but mad North by Northwest, which is where the title comes from. And even then it was just Hamlet trying to be like, I'm kind of crazy guys, but I'm not that crazy. And it's like, it's literally Hitchcock being like, welcome to my twisted world. Like, you're in for a wild ride.
I love how it can't wait to get there either. Not even long as like to have a return to normalcy in the after the final scene between that and literally the closing of the movie. I don't know anything about how movies are made, so I don't know if it was like this is cut for time or if like it was a very intentional directorial choice, but it works very well to bring us directly from the most climactic moment of the movie. She's about to fall off of Mount Rushmore to her death. And instead of that, he's pulling her up and he calls her Mrs. Thornhill
and they're back in the train.
He fists her. There's no way that like, in context of this movie, if we actually did get a scene where like, oh, he pulls her up and they're safe and then it fades to them either wedding or waiting for the train or on the train or whatever, way like weaker, different. I think it would maybe have sort of like lost that. Of course, it loses momentum.
They do the New Hope ending where he's getting a medal and everybody's standing there and it's like, bah, 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 bah.
No, the important thing is that they fuck. James Bond used that trick in 50% of the fucking movies, right?
Where I mean, like, Red wants a fish.
He should have known.
Floatable thing, floating away from the bad guy's face.
For sure.
Yeah. Like, James Bond was like, yeah, but they're fucking. We're just going to say it. You know what I mean?
You know how we would end Trilibs? Where it's like, and everybody watched a movie, the end of James Bond is, and then they fuck the end. Without fail. It's amazing.
It really is. Hitchcock's one cameo in this movie is just making the penis and whole like hand signals throughout the movie.
You do wonder what Hitchcock was like making movies now, like what would that freak be up to? You know what I mean? Because back in the day, it's like, I'll have a train going into a tunnel and that will signify to the audience.
I'm in an Uber.
Genuinely, I think we know the answer to that question. It's Brian De Palma.
Oh, I was going to say actual pornography, but yes, maybe that too.
Yeah, truly.
Same thing.
That like makes me think of, and it might be a juncture thought, but I'll wait on actually pulling it open in the case there's a whole discussion. We brought up the train scene that is like, not only is it incredibly like, overly horny, the visuals and the dialogue is like very explicitly, not explicitly, but like clearly this is a sexual conversation about each other's bodies, but like it's in a distinctly 20th century way that I can't quite put my finger on, that like in a 21st century way, there's like this instinctive, we're going to talk around it. We're going to have like this many jokes and poking and prodding, no pun intended. And in this way, in this movie, like they are directly talking about, being on each other and like having him in her and just like very, I don't know, it manages in a fun way to like, as a center point of the movie, as literally like Aaron was saying, a huge moment for the character that he finally has like a personal stake necessarily in pursuing this line of like toward truth, toward whatever he's reaching by the end. it hinges on this incredibly like sexy conversation between them.
Yeah,
where they don't even know each other's names yet.
And even that feels like a parody, right? It feels like a Hays Code parody or something. Where it's like Hitchcock saying, like, movies were always about sex. They've always been about sex. Like, we found all of these clever ways to sort of hide that, to sort of, like, allude to that. I'm doing the same thing now, but in such a ridiculously obvious way.
Yes.
Right? Like, the last scene of this movie, that it becomes a parody of that, where it's just like, hey, like, everybody wants sex in the movies. That's what movies are. Like, look at this version of that, right? And it's like it directly prefigures James Bond, like you said, where it's just like there are no bones about it. It's just like everybody – no bones about it. everybody's just horny, right? And it's just sort of like it's his version of like piss-taking that.
They're being so blatant in that conversation in a way that like they're both saying, what if I said this? Wouldn't that be blatant? But like guising it through performance and through some of the like walking back that they do to like keep that tension up and down throughout the conversation. I don't know. It's just like a unique little bit of dialogue and filming that I think it feels like a product of its time and like in a way that movies aren't going to try today because they've got to either be incredibly obvious to be comedic or they've got to be so surreptitious as to be dramatic. But in this case, it's like we both know that we both want to, that the movie is calling for us to be very blatant, very over the top because the whole movie has this comedic tone about it. We're going to like, in addition to that, to play the characters as they might meet on this train. We're going to like, but you know what I'm saying, right, about it. I know I'm making it sound like every other sexual innuendo scene in the world, but there is something a little bit...
No, I mean, there's something almost, and, you know, obviously this is evoked by the title, but, like, Shakespearean about it, right? Where it's, like, it almost gets funny in Shakespeare, the like, lengths of wordplay that characters go, and you're just like, oh, my God, just fuck already. And, like, that's how you feel here, too, right? It's like watching Much Ado About Nothing and being like, fuck off. Like, we know what you guys are crazy about each other. Like, just,
you're talking about biting your thumb at that man. Of course you want to fuck him.
and it's like, that's almost this version of that, right? But like, magnified to, like, the nth degree, where it's just like, hey, like, what if we cut all of that out? And, like, we have these two characters who are occupying this scene in which they are supposed to be doing this, like, witty repartee Shakespearean thing, but instead they're just repeatedly saying to each other, hey, what if we went to your room and fucked? And it's like, it works. It's hilarious.
It is way funnier than it should be. And way more, I guess, I light-handed in a way. I don't know. I think I've already described it as best I'm going to. You probably said it better than I did. I'm ready to take us to the junk drawer. If everybody else is ready for that. That was kind of one of my junk drawer thoughts, but I'm glad we got a little bit of mileage out of it. This is the junk drawer where we shove all the other thoughts that didn't fit in the larger conversation. I've got a few from this movie, you might imagine, but I will hand it off actually to Harry. You never start these things. Harry, would you tell me if you've got any junk drawer thoughts?
Sure. I said it before, but Jesse Royce Landis plays Clara Thornhill, the mom, who I really thought for the first like half hour of this movie was going to be the buddy cop or like the detective opposite him. She fucking kills it in this movie. She's so funny. She like is really like everybody kills it in this movie. It must be said, right? Like, Eva Marie Saint, is perfect opposite Cary Grant. But she's so funny in it. That's a big drunk drawer thought, is just shout out to her. And then shout out to like just the Cary Grant scene, which is the auctioneering scene when he gets out of being murdered by the evil assassins just by making the biggest ass of himself imaginable.
Great.
And it's just like, that's absolutely, it's like you genius Hitchcock, you found the perfect way to use to leverage Cary Grant. It's just like, he's just in this auctioneering house. These assassins just want to get him out of the room so that they can murder him. And he makes such a big asshole out of himself that the police come and take him away instead. And then he's in the police car and he's like, excellent job, gentlemen. You've just saved my life. And it's like, fuck, like that's such a good sequence. It's so over the top. Yeah, it's so, but it's like, that's really, so that's maybe my favorite scene in the movie. Lots of great stuff. And then, you know, just like the general thing of like, it's wild how well this set piece at the end of the movie works, despite the fact that like the movie that came before it was so self-parodying and that the set piece is so long and so like it, the most like Hitchcocked up, overdone set piece ever, where they're literally like on Mount Rushmore and it's like, do you get it? Do you get the symbolism here?
Yeah.
And it still fucking all works. And it just like, it's, yeah, I don't know, man. It just like,
he has this magnificent way of sort of just making everything sing. Just through, like, he's just going to mug his way through it, and it's going to work out. And it absolutely just carries this movie.
There's been a restaurant next door I work downtown here in Chicago that has had a little sign outside for, I think it's Italian. Let me look up the actual restaurant, but they've had a sign that says bring back the martini lunch, and they just like put it outside, and I guess they do martini lunches. And this movie really makes me want to do a martini lunch. It's The Village. It's like an Italian restaurant. It's like a big, honestly, it kind of looks like Olive. It looks like a, how do I explain this? Like a big non-chain Olive Garden called The Village. I've been wanting to go there, but yeah, they have a sign advertising the martini lunch. I think we need to bring it back. Getting drunk at like 12:30 on a Wednesday. That's it.
The Amtrak now goes all the way to Chicago from Minneapolis. So
technically it did, but there's another.
Does it drive through any tunnels on the way there? Does it drive? You know how trains drive? Anyway.
Yeah. Good question. But yeah, come the St. Paul to Chicago. Multiple new departure times.
Yeah.
God, I wish I would have let this end on martini lunches, because I don't know if anybody's going to beat that. But I really want to shout out the airplane sequence again. Just to, like, not every like big movie set piece, like the biggest thing that like the zeitgeist will extract from a movie, and like that is just the image that the movie is known for. Not all of those necessarily hold up like within the movie's context. Like they might be great within the movie's context. Anytime I revisit this movie, I'm just like, man, that scene is even better than I remember. Like it's so good. I can't remember if we set it up, but like, Eve sets up, she tells Thornhill that she has arranged a meeting for him to meet with Kaplan, and basically sends him to this desolate like road amidst this like cornfield. And in an instance of the movie kind of training you what to look for, it's just like any vehicle or person that approaches, and you can like see them coming from, you know, a half a mile away. You can hear them. You got to wait for like 30 seconds for them to like pass or to like approach. And then you're just like, are you Kaplan? Are you Kaplan? Nope. What's that airplane? What's that crop duster doing in the distance? That's weird. It's like big bus, just like a bunch of folks passing through. Just like you're waiting. You know that somebody or something is going to encounter this guy eventually. And then surprise, it's the fucking plane.
It's so good. The lead up is so good to it. There's like three fake outs, and then there's like a whole conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, man. And also that scene, hilarious, because he ends up like killing the airplane with an oil like truck.
Killing the airplane.
He does. He fucking takes it down, dude.
He ends up killing the airplane. He kills the airplane. This is video game brain just slowly rotting you.
It's so good. Kill, and that explosion is so satisfying. And yeah, I love that like he's almost hit, and then those like oil guys are like Johnny on the spot, where they're like, get out of here, the other one's gonna explode. It's like, well, thanks, guy who almost hit me with the truck. Like, you were really like looking out for me there. I love that, like, it's the most like movie ass scene of all time, where it's just like it's just this giant empty field that like looks like nowhere on the planet. And like they even lampshade that, right? Like the farmer or whatever that's waiting for the bus is like, that crop duster's cropped and dusting where there ain't no crops. And it's like, yeah, you're right. That does look really funny and stupid. That does really look like a movie. Farmer guy.
Folksy Iowa, probably nothing. Just us dumb Midwesterners.
It's just like, it looks like Waiting for Godot, right? Where like you keep waiting for like there just to be like one sad tree in like the extreme background.
Right. My Dinner with Kaplan. that scene rules. Sorry, Aaron, you had something.
Did you guys ever the Cary Grant almost getting run over, and then the did you guys ever, as like a kid watching, for me it was like Raiders of the Lost Ark, any movie where like people go under cars, did you ever think about how horrifying it must be to have a car drive over you and just all that?
It's gotta suck so much, dude.
It's just skin you. Oh, that's gotta suck.
I think as a dumb kid who knew nothing about cars, and an adult who still knows nothing about cars, there's still a part of me that's like, like any android that looks like a human where it's just like, oh, it's just a bump down there. There's no like, there's no genitalia. There's no, that's my still perception of a vehicle, even though I know that that's not the case. They're just like, oh, it's a smooth underbelly. He can just like slide right under it. So I didn't actively think about that as a kid, but in retrospect, I probably should have, because that's dangerous and it would have prevented me from running out in traffic. But the only other thing I wanted to call out, I don't know if I've ever noticed it before in this movie, but when Cary Grant is about to hop in the shower, he starts whistling Singing in the Rain.
I paused. I watched this on Amazon. Don't give Bezos money. Sorry that I did. But when you pause it, literally, like, it's the scene is like Cary Grant and Eva Marie Saint and Singing in the Rain. Like, right, Fred right. It's like, oh, really? Wait, what? And like, I went back because I was like, Singing in the Rain is not in this fucking movie. And then he's whistling it. Yeah. It was so such a good moment.
It adds to the lampoonery, tomfoolery of just Hitchcock being like, all right, why not? We're having a fun one today, boys. Let's have at it. You know, good movie. Singing in the Rain, but also North by Northwest, for what it's worth. A couple of good movies today, fellas.
Very good movies. Nobody's talking about that, how North by Northwest is Singing in the Rain.
It's upsetting how nobody is talking about right this second. It's not trending on the internet how great these movies are. False outrage. Shout outs.
Nobody tweets about North by Northwest anymore. I will give a quick junk drawer shout out to the Columbo episode Double Shock, which features Martin Landau, who plays Van Damme's right-hand man, in two roles. He plays twins as this, both the victim and one of the victims and a murderer. It's a fantastic, fun episode.
Should this be a new segment where you just fill us in on however the latest Columbo you watched relates to the movie that
we're going to keep doing episodes on movies from like the 40s through maybe the early late 70s? Yes, absolutely we should, because they're always going to have some fucking
every single actor was in Columbo, and you can just be like, Jason's Columbo. I actually love that. Keep doing that, Jason. I like it very much.
I like
Jason's Columbo Corner, or just Jason's Columbies.
Jason's Columbies. I will need somebody to make a sound effect for me, though, because I don't know if I can do that for myself. excuse me. Junk drawer shout out to when he's talking to his mom on the phone the next morning after having been drunked, as he says, and he's talking to his mom and he's like, they just put a lot of bourbon in me. And then he's like, no, they didn't give me a chaser.
Oh, dude. Yeah. The phone call conversation is so good. Or like, and then like 5 seconds later, he's talking to the cop and he's like, who's asking? Sergeant Emil. And he's like, Emil? Emil, like, and I can't remember the guy's last name, but then he's like, oh yeah, it's Sergeant Emil. Yeah, I couldn't believe it either. like that's what she's asking him about. Is like, wait, his name's Emil?
I'm coming to the realization now that we're just praising Cary Grant as an actor, but okay, fine.
He's so good.
As a vehicle for him, this movie is even fantastic. That I already mentioned it, but that lady in the next hospital room who says stop and then puts on her glasses and then she's like, stop. And he says, and the scene ends. I thought it was going to go on. So I thought she was going to become part of the scene and I was going to be like, it's less of a fun bit if it becomes part of the movie, part of the scene. Just ends. It's just, again, Hitchcock being a funny, horny old man.
It's like a fucking, like, we just watched the Spider-Man movies. It's like a Sam Raimi bit, right? Where Spider-Man flows overhead and there's just hot women staring at him. And it's just like, then the movie just keeps going. And it's like, oh, Spider-Man's sexy. Okay.
Right. Well, Jason, the end of that scene when he, like, awkwardly, like, sashays Fred Astaire dance moves out of the room, his hair is kind of like parted to the side, like he's got some weird like bags under his eyes. Spider-Man 3, everyone, give it a watch.
Spider-Man 3, give it a rewatch. I will say this, as the final Spider Mondays I partook in was Spider-Man 3 here, and I can attest it deserves a reevaluation. I was on the skeptical side, having given it a 2 on Letterboxd the last time I watched it just a couple of years ago. It's a 3.5 movie for me. That's not a junk drawer thought about this movie though, and because it's not, I should have already closed up this junk drawer with a sound effect that goes like that. I still don't have a sound effect for everybody's favorite segment. It's called To All the Loves We've Tried Before. Any movie that we've covered from the year 1959, which is the year in which this movie released, it gets its own little shout out on this segment. But you know what? I will give, I don't have any cash on me, I don't know, $1 to whoever can tell me what the last movie we covered from 1959 was. I will leave it open. Oh, I don't have my Jeopardy sound effect, I don't think. But I will simply, after... episode one on the 400 blows. Yeah, right.
Your favorite movie.
Are you serious?
I'm serious.
A Kurosawa didn't come out in 1959. That
no,
we
Yojimbo was 60.
60, yeah, I guess.
And then Sanjuro 61, 62, something like that. Absolutely. I was floored. But I should say,
which is a hilarious episode because it's our first ever episode of the podcast. We're covering a classic, and that whole time Jason's just like, I don't really like this movie. I don't really get it. It's like kind of like I don't see what the big deal is.
Maybe it deserves a reevaluation because some degree of media literacy needed to be honed in, filed down.
Hey man, maybe you were right.
Maybe
you
I was right.
Could have been right. Maybe you'll be vindicated.
Doesn't clear. But I will say, in searching for the year 1959 in our episodes, I found that the year that A Brighter Summer Day from 1991 is set in Taipei in the year 1959. Just a bit of trivia, little trivia, a bit within the bit, if you will. That was To All the Loves We've Tried Before. And with that out of the way, we have one final segment of the show, and Harry needs to help me ring it in. Welcome back, Aaron. You can join if you like. If you can make it next time, maybe punt it to then. But I do need at least Harry in the chorus here.
Of course, Jason. It's the final segment, the segment we like to call
Cody's Noties.
Wow. Thank you, gentlemen, for that monumental introduction. This week, we're going to take a look back at Hitchcock's filmography with something a little different. This is the Tri-Love Movie Draft, wherein our panelists will aim to create the best possible roster of movies by means of a snake draft. The theme of this week's draft is films directed by Alfred Hitchcock. And just so y'all have a reference, I'm going to drop a link in the recording chat here just so you can pull those up. First and foremost, disclaimer, getting this out of the way. Some of us have been pretty critical in various private podcast adjacent group chats lately about hacky podcast bullshit, taking content from other works, podcasts, YouTube channels, things like
not
that.
Are we starting a beef right now?
I've never listened to The Big Picture, which I think is the Ringer's podcast. My understanding is that they sort of ran with the idea of a quote unquote movie draft, being a sports person and a fantasy sports person, hearing about that sort of thing. Can't lie. The idea of witnessing a movie draft with some level of investment, like the kind that I have today, has always sounded kind of cool. So here we are, giving due credit, shout out to them. There's no monetary investment nor high stakes expectations for any of this, so I feel comfortable with it. So let's go ahead and move on. Here's what's going to happen. Once I'm done giving this preamble, I will spin our order wheel that we have on our side to kind of randomize the order for things to determine the draft order of this draft, at which point the first person will draft their first Hitchcock film, the second person will draft theirs, and the third person will draft theirs. And then because this is a snake draft, what that's going to do is then it'll start, the second round will begin with person number three, it'll snake back the opposite direction. So 3-2-1, and then 1-2-3 again. The draft will proceed until the three of you have a roster of four Hitchcock films that you believe is, again, the best, most well-rounded roster of Alfred Hitchcock movies possible. You may be wondering, who will decide which roster is the best? And the answer is our Twitter following. So as the impartial moderator, I will take the lead on tweeting out a poll when this episode drops on Tuesday. Our audience will have, I don't know, we'll say like 24 hours to vote on their favorite roster of Hitchcock films. So you are catering to our listeners. You are maybe a little bit of pandering, any other sort of diplomacy or politics you want to toss into this. With that, we'll determine our draft order shortly, and I will link y'all a shared doc that we can all use to kind of track these as we go. I will drop that in our chat here. Let me know if that doesn't pull up. Shouldn't be editable. If you ask for edit access, you will be disqualified. You won't. I'll just be a little annoyed. But this is where we're at. So we got, it's a blank canvas upon which we will populate it with Hitchcock movies. I'm going to spin the wheel to determine who is going to draft first, and I will note that in the document here as well. So spinning the wheel, the first pick in the draft is going to go to one Aaron Grossman. I will just note that here. I will figure out the rest of the order before we actually jump in. The second pick in the draft is going to go to Harry, and Jason will hold the third pick. And again, snake draft, so 1-2-3, 3-2-1, 1-2-3, 3-2-1. So I'll just note these here. First pick, I didn't think to institute a clock, but let's just get through this in as timely of a fashion as we can. I will fill out this table here. With the first overall pick in the Trilove movie draft, the Hitchcock rendition, the first pick goes to Aaron. Aaron, do you know who you're drafting first overall?
You're on mute, my man.
It's a resounding yes. It's a resounding yes. Aaron, my guy, you are on mute.
You're still on mute, my man. You've been on mute this whole time.
Okay. Technical difficulties over here. I'm going to be graceful. Thank you. I'm going to pick Rear Window. Instead of maybe a slightly better answer.
Rear Window. We got hey, do nice guys finish first? We'll find out on Tuesday. We've got Rear Window noted. Second pick over to Harry. Harry, who are you taking? Or what movie are you taking with your first pick?
Thanks, Cody. Rear Window is a great first seater, TBH.
I left you Vertigo on purpose. I left you on purpose. Yeah.
Listen, I like Vertigo a lot, but like it's divisive. I think it's one of the more divisive.
Oh, come on.
I'll do Vertigo.
You
sure.
think so?
Yeah.
I think there are a lot of
people, including your favorite director of all time, Quentin Tarantino, who hate.
Vertigo. My favorite director of all time.
It's your favorite director of all time. You know, Hateful Eight.
I'll take it for the bit. You know.
All right. Sure. I'm doing Vertigo.
Good bit. Perfect. Gotcha. Locked in with Vertigo. Over to Jason. Jason, your first pick of the draft, if you will.
You know what? I'm going to court the queer vote. I'm going to go for Rebecca.
Interesting. Great movie. Alrighty.
I know our Twitter following.
One of my mom's favorite movies of all time. So if she votes on this, she'll probably go with you.
I'm recording the Mackin vote.
Unless I put my finger on the scale. Happy birthday, Mom. By the way, we're recording this on my mom's birthday.
Happy birthday, Harry's mom. This is dedicated to you, unless a better sponsor comes along, in which case, sorry, Harry's mom. But Jason, you actually have the next pick in the draft as well because of the nature of a snake draft. So who are you taking with your second pick?
I'm dispensing with it. It's Rear Window is going to be my second.
Well, you can't because it's already taken.
Oh, no, I said I wanted Rear Window as my second?
Yes.
Yeah.
Rear Window.
You can't. Once a movie is taken off the board, it is donezo.
Then we will do Rope, please.
Rope. It'd be wild if like every team drafted Yao Ming. Just like, I also want Yao Ming, actually.
I thought that's what made it a fantasy, is that you could just choose anything.
No is the answer I'll go with. So that is a fair clarification to folks who may not be familiar with drafts. Once an item has been drafted, a person, a movie, what have you, once it is claimed, it is off the board. So you have to use the tools at your disposal. The neurons will be firing to as you think about what will comprise the best roster. Speaking of rosters, Jason's got a roster going. He's got two picks. We're going over to Harry for his second pick.
Cody, unbelievably generous of you not to go for the easiest leg sweep of all time and simply say a little clarification on draft for those of you who may have been homeschooled.
You know what? You can take that. Jason, feel free to edit around that. I don't expect you to because it is at your expense. But kudos to you, Harry, for landing on that one.
I'm not going to overthink this, Cody. I'm just going to go with Psycho.
Fuck you. That would have been so easy.
You know, you're going to be a gentleman, you know? Aaron, that was not in my vocabulary.
Yeah, I thought for sure he wasn't going to take Rope. It's fine.
What you going to go with then?
So I guess I get two picks in a row here, right?
Mm-hmm. But which one are you going to draft first? That's maybe like an intangible variable to all of this.
Fuck. I'll go with North by Northwest.
Lowercase.
Oh, you can just keep in the duck, Cody. I'm just going to pick that one too.
Sorry. Everybody vote for the dumb homeschooled boy who doesn't know how drafts work. Don't let him sway you. No, I got to be impartial. Anything that they say or put forth is fair for consideration. Speaking of consideration, for your consideration, Aaron, who are you taking third?
This is where like you either get really fucking, you start Man, do not put Pleasure Garden down.
For listeners, yeah, I'm putting Pleasure Garden.
Yeah, good in bit. I guess cells. I'll just go with, I don't actually like the person. Fucking it. You know what? I'll do stage fright. I'll go with my heart.
Let's go.
My heart is in stage fright. I'm going with stage fright.
Aaron may have just clinched my vote there, fellas. But hey, a lot can happen.
You don't get to vote.
I have a Twitter account. I'm pretty sure I can vote.
I don't like that. I don't think that's right.
Recount.
We'll see. Yeah, I don't know. Will I vote? Yeah, I don't know. I did say I'm an impartial observer. I will give everybody equal praise. How about that? Harry, your third pick. Two solid picks. Vertigo, Psycho. Are there any other titles that end in an O that you want to land upon for the bit?
Do I want to run the gambit, so to speak? Are there any other Hitchcock
that's
titles?
A good spell about no?
I'm looking real quick, so don't count this against me.
39 Steppos.
Always Tell Your Wife is a hilarious name for a movie. I've never heard of that movie before, but shout outs. It's from 1923. God damn, Hitchcock. I'm going to quote the Cody vote. Now that we know that Cody is putting his hat in the ring, I'm going to go with Dial In for Murder for my third pick. Thank you.
Ooh, that is... would four be capitalized? No, that would be... that's interesting. There are a few different ways you can go if you were courting the Cody vote. Dial In for Murder, though. That's, you will be courting some votes with that one, for sure. That is, an unsung gem of Hitchcock's. I only saw it once.
I saw it at the Riverview.
I think it's quite sung.
The seats at the Riverview, they always make my knees hurt, kind of put me in a bad mood.
They need to replace them. They've been like bowing a bit
listen,
too forward.
I love the Riverview. It's a neighborhood icon. It's like a block from my sister's house. I'm there a lot. They maybe need to replace like everything inside that actual theater.
The entire theater.
Yeah.
I get that it's a historical landmark. I love the marquee. Maybe just, you know, the screen's a little stained, guys.
Yeah, I remember my knees hurting when I sit in certain of those seats. And we need a third movie from Jason, who has Rebecca and Rope. Are there any other R movies of Hitchcock's that you feel like you could draft? Rear Window is not on the table any longer.
Oh,
not
no.
eligible to be picked. But we will take your third pick.
You go whenever wrong, you man. Have.
You know, I haven't seen too many more of Hitchcock's movies, actually. So this is going to be all... It'd be like not knowing anything about sports and trying to put together a roster.
Right.
I'm going to go for Marnie because I watched part of that one once upon a time.
Marnie. You are courting the lady boat, Rebecca.
Jason says Marnie and me.
That's right. And you have one more pick, Jason, as we sneak back to you. We're in the final round of this draft. So what are you going to take to round out your roster?
You know what?
Just like to point out that Alfred Hitchcock in 1931 made a movie called The Skin Game.
he has always
known what he's about.
Alfred, you gross pervert. Jason, take it away.
You know, the only other Hitchcock film I've seen than the one we've already taken is The Pleasure Garden, and there's no way I'm putting that on my list. So I'm going to go with the next movie I plan to watch from him, which is To Catch a Thief.
There we go. I don't know what to say about that. I've seen it once. Grace Kelly's in it. She's great.
Cary Grant, Grace Kelly.
Cary Grant's the lead. We'll see if the To Catch a Thief Hive rises up for that one.
You know what else Grace Kelly is in?
What's that?
Dial In for Murder.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Singing in the Rain because of the reference earlier.
That'd be great if she was in Singing in
the
Rain.
Yeah, she's not. She's not. Unfortunately.
Unfortunately. But what will you take, Harry, with your final pick
Singing
in this draft?
Wait, I get another one?
Enough.
Oh, it's four. That's cool.
Yeah.
I forgot about that. Let's see. I'm going to go with Spellbound. Cody?
Spellbound Cody. Very good. Very good. All right. So Harry's got his roster put together.
Hey,
and Aaron. Yeah.
How offensive do you guys think Jamaica Inn is, by the way? The Alfred Hitchcock movie from 1939.
I love
Jamaica
that you're just looking
Inn?
Up honorable mentions for picks that you would like never make in this.
Yeah, you actually can't even log it on Letterboxd. It's just there for auspicious whatever.
It remains to be seen by any of us and probably ever. But Aaron, with the final pick in the draft, what are you going to go with?
I'm basically just playing to win at this point, and I'm wondering whether The Birds, Strangers on a Train, or Notorious, or maybe Shadow of a Doubt would
this
get
MF
me the most
saw the top 10
here.
And he's like, give me all them top 10.
No, I mean, that's the, I like all the movies above, but I am now purely practical, cold-hearted. Mm-hmm. I think I'm going to say that I think Strangers on a Train would be the most practical decision here. I'm going to go with that.
Gotcha. And this is another Cody vote tempting exercise, because Strangers on a Train, you know what it's about? It's about a tennis player, folks.
Yeah. Also,
it's about a tennis player. And lots of
tragically, Aaron forgot about one brief scene near the end where there is very egregious blackface. He is disqualified from this competition. That doesn't happen. I'm just joking.
It does happen in some of his other films.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know.
Yeah, he was yeah. British. It's fine. Yeah.
Well, very good. Thank you, gentlemen. We've got our Hitchcock movie rosters put together. I'll read these off and I'll tweet out a graphic and a poll on Tuesday. But we've got Aaron's picks in order of 1 to 4: Rear Window, North by Northwest, Stage Fright, Strangers on a Train.
Strong set. It must be said. That's a fucking knockout.
Yeah. Harry's picks, we got Vertigo, Psycho, Dial M for Murder, and Spellbound.
Strong set, it must be said. That's a really thing.
Please don't make this joke bad.
And then Jason's picks, we've got Rebecca, Rope, Marnie, and To Catch a Thief.
Not honestly, as strong of a set as the other two sets.
Listen,
it must be said very clearly.
Listen, we all played a good game. All right, we all
what matters
played
is
a strong,
we all had fun.
We showed up. You know, the movies were picked.
Listen,
and
we did it. All it takes is for one Rebecca Hive Twitter account to rise up, retweet it, and it's over for the rest
of
the
year. I'm expecting it from all of you.
Last night, Jason dreamt of victory again. Am I right? Am I right, Becca Heads?
But yeah, TBD on if we bring this back and if we hijack other podcast bits going forward. We'll see how this goes. Vote to your heart's content over the 24-hour period or however long we set the poll for. But beyond that, thank you. This has been the Trial of Movie Draft, brought to you by Alfred Hitchcock's Filmography. I guess we don't really have a POP unless that's just like shared by everybody here.
It'll be in Twitter after the results of the poll.
Oh yeah. Yeah. A virtual POP, virtual pop. All right. That's all I got. Thanks, fellas.
Jason, producer here. Thanks for listening, everybody. Actually, the poll already went out and I've already edited the episode and it's already gone through. I've already edited the episode and this is just a postscriptum to let everybody know. I don't know why I left that sound bit from Harry in, but clear winner was Jason's. I'm just objectively reporting his roster with 116,000 votes. I'm sorry, my 116,000 votes came out clear winner. Zero votes actually for either Harry or Aaron. I guess Cody must have been lying. I didn't check about his methodology. I tried to separate myself from it. So thank you so much for listening.
Marnie.
We'll get into the outro now. So thanks.
I'm Jason Daphnis, and I steal from my mom's poll.
No, Cody, there is no pop-up platform this time, but we're all winners in a certain respect. We'll see how the poll turns out. I guess that's Tuesday. If you're waiting for it, we'll do some hype, some prep, and you can check it out at Try Love Podcast. Thank you, Cody, for ending our... It's an interesting version of Cody's Noties, where there is nothing to quite celebrate except the games itself, so I really appreciate that nice, fun spin. Hope this comes back at some point, because now I understand how rosters work. You can't get it by me for very long, more than twice. Check us out on Twitter at Try Love Podcast, join the Trylon, and their upcoming schedule at Trylon.org and a Trial on Cinema on all social media you go to. Well, maybe except Pinterest. I don't know if they're there. You can find me. I'm Jason Daphnis at Nintendoofus, also on most social media.
That's right. I've been Cody Narvison. You can find me on Blue Sky and Pinterest at Cody Narvison, as well as Twitter at Cody_BH.
I've been Harry Mackin. For the record, not to put you on the spot there, Jason, the Trylon has a pretty great Instagram. They take pictures from inside the booth a lot, which is really cool. So you can check them out there. You can check them out everywhere else. I've been Harry Mack, and you can check out Godzilla on my Instagram at Shiitake Harry.
My name is Aaron. You can find me on Twitter at RBPlease, and I will be watching. Oh, that's next month that I'm watching all Godzilla movies. Never mind. We'll talk about it later. Go check out Godzilla on Harry's Instagram.
Now you listen to me. I'm an advertising man, not a red herring. I've got a job, a secretary, a mother, two ex-wives, and several bartenders that depend on me, and I don't intend to disappoint them all by getting myself slightly killed.